For the second week in a row, that middle song is like one we've never done before. It seems that way. I think we have done it, but we need a little practice on that one. Kevin Ford, who wrote that hymn, is a member in England. I knew him when I was over there years ago. Well, this past week, my granddaughter Lacey, who's with us today, has been in golf camp. A golf camp she's attended before. It's been about 3 years since she's been in golf camp. She was last in golf camp, I think, when she was about 9 years old. And we have probably eight or nine kids your age, right around her age group then at that time. So a lot of camaraderie, new friends, and we didn't know how many people would show up. But on Tuesday morning, she was there at 7 o'clock, and we didn't really know until just before that there were only going to be four people in the class. So, of course, Lacey, like any of us at that age, is kind of wondering, okay, who's going to show up? Is it going to be girls or boys or whatever? Lacey's 12. And then we saw three other kids come in. And two of them were five, so they're about half Lacey's size in height. And the other one was a boy in her class, but he was not as tall as Lacey. He was a very good golfer, I guess. But we're standing on the practice green waiting for all the other kids, or the other three kids, to join. And Lacey looked at me and she said, GP, like, really? I mean, is this all there is? But as she got into the class, I mean, I was far removed. I have one of the pros that conduct the class and teaching them the fundamentals of golf and going over all of that again. And they have different activities, and they take them to different places on the golf course or in the practice area and help them learn new skills in this sport. And so I think that Lacey and the other little boy, the other boy her age, were assigned to hit balls into target nets, you know, about 15 feet or 20 feet away, or hitting up to the practice green. Two little five-year-old boys, I guess for 5 years old, very interested in golf. But at one point, and imagine this is a practice area, if you can think about this, nice green expanse, short grass, and literally hundreds, dozens and hundreds of practice balls all over the place. And so these little boys were looking at one ball by the green. They had run out of balls to hit, so they saw one ball with, you know, apart from that, there's dozens and hundreds elsewhere all over the place. Just think about that. Golf balls. But they each saw this one ball, and they made a mad scramble for it. And they both had to have that single ball. And what ensued was, you know, one of them grabbed the ball, the other one jumped on his back and knocked him over, and they started wrestling around. And here they are wrestling around for 5 minutes before the assistant pro comes back from something he was doing, getting some other thing set up for them. And he said, "What are you guys doing anyway?" "Well, he took that ball, and I wanted it." "No, you were going after the ball I wanted." And, you know, so they were going over one stupid ball. And when Lacey told me about it, it was so funny. You know, the whole purpose of golf camp is to learn how to golf, not how to wrestle. They were perfecting their wrestling skills over one golf ball. I wonder if that is how God sometimes views us. When we argue over non-essential things, like a couple of five-year-old boys arguing over a single golf ball. Last week, the title of the sermon was Things That Matter, and I talked about some of the things, not all of the things, obviously, but some of the things I've experienced in 47 years as a member of the Church of God. Most of them are experiences that Terry and I shared together as a couple in the ministry. So the point of last week's sermon was agree or disagree. There are things that are important. There are things that really matter. And sometimes there are things that are of lesser importance, but sometimes those things of lesser importance almost take on the aura of doctrine or teaching, or they become de facto teaching and have in the Church of God. And in fact, as I'll show today, that's the way it's been since the inception of the church and even going back before that. One of the passages that I left out last week in Matthew 23, if you'll turn there, because I needed to have a follow-up topic, right? No, that was another reason. But in Matthew 23, we touched on this passage, but not to a great extent. But I'd like to more fully explain that today. And through the summer, not next week or the week after, but in a little while, we'll be talking a little bit more about God's law this summer. So that will be coming. But in Matthew 23 and verse 23, Jesus Christ made it very, very clear in this chapter as to what is really important in terms of the law. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, and those are justice, mercy, and faith." He says, you shouldn't not do the things that are of lesser importance. You should do those things. You should tithe. "These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." Now, some of the language that Christ uses in the parables and in this instance is somewhat hyperbole. There's a little bit of an exaggeration. I don't know of any other place that it shows that the Pharisees actually tithed on small, tiny herbs, but that is, what would you do if you brought that to the temple? I mean, how would you disperse that? I mean, how much is a tithe? Well, they did that. That's apparently what they did. But all of the law is important, so don't get me wrong, and don't take the sermon in a direction that I don't intend it to take or mean something that I don't. I'm timing myself here, so pardon me. We should be diligent to perform every aspect of God's law. But how are we in performing in our Christian walk, in our lives, the weightier matters of the law? Because this is what Jesus Christ said was really important: justice, mercy, and faith. And that's the title today: justice, mercy, and faith. I just hope that I can do some justice to the title. So last week I spoke, and for those of you that are visiting, you know, some of this might be church speak, but you can probably relate to it in other areas of your life. But in our church belief system, going back now five decades, there were in the past, there were some areas, and maybe these areas are important to people now still, okay? Let's not get carried away and throw the baby out with the bathwater, because some of these things probably are still important to us. I know that some of them are important to me, but dietary issues, I think the Church of God, going way back to the 50s, was probably in the forefront of the organic and natural movement and dietary issues. I mentioned whole wheat was big. Well, I talked several months ago about how Terry learned to bake whole wheat bread in South Dakota, and that's all we had as a family, was homemade whole wheat bread. Oh boy, was it good. And I've talked about how you could smell that bread, and you know, it was good that my metabolism rate was higher then, because you put that whole wheat bread together with some butter, warm out of the oven. You don't even need to toast it. Put some whole wheat honey on top of that. Boy, you're going good. Just kidding. White sugar was not allowed. It was a big thing. It was a big thing. White sugar, not good. I mentioned Ken Swisher seeing Mr. Armstrong one day drink a Coca-Cola down and was first, as a student in 1955, shocked. But then, okay, well, he's the pastor general. It must be balanced, and it must be okay to occasionally have a soda. In your culture, it was whole wheat tortillas, right? Whole wheat tortillas, whole wheat beans, right? Okay.
And no lard,
right, right. Health issues, visiting doctors in some areas was not prescribed. Vaccinations, not good. Don't get your kids vaccinated, blah, blah. Some people really have gotten big on homeschooling. Homeschooling can be good if you can get some certification, if you're the teacher. I mean, homeschooling can be great, but you know what I told some young couples in wisdom far advanced above my years in my 20s, back in South Dakota was, you know, your kids should also be socialized in other areas too, because, you know, you just can't use the excuse of homeschooling to keep everybody out of the world, because sometimes you're going to be exposed to this nasty world, and it is bad. So those efforts are noble, and it can be great, you know, other things, celebration of birthdays, issues that are on the periphery of Bible information. You know, the old stance that we had in terms of birthdays was every time a birthday is mentioned in the Bible, like with Job's sons and daughters, which you cannot really prove that that was a birthday celebration or anything, but maybe you can, I don't know, but something bad happens, you know. The birthday of King Herod's niece, you know, the beheading of John the Baptist, et cetera, or his wife's birthday. So by extension, they became de facto doctrine in the Church of God, and it's not as though you can really prove that. Now, do I think a massive celebration honoring me is necessary on November 23rd? Did everybody get that date? Everybody? No. No. Well, actually, I go beyond that. I'm of the age now where I've labeled it my birth month, so we take it all the way to Christmas, so and beyond to New Year's. Just kidding. Jury duty, voting, all of those were verboten. And I'm not saying that these aren't issues you should consider on a personal basis. Please do. Please. I'm not legislating for the church or anything else. But some of them aren't issues that the Church of God can legislate authoritatively and claim as doctrine in the Church of God. It may be something that you're not willing to do. I've mentioned the example of the lady in the South Dakota church in Rapid City who told the judge, you know, I want to be excused for religious reasons because I don't want to sit in judgment of somebody else. Now, that's a good excuse. You don't want to sit in judgment of somebody else. And the judge said, fine, you know, I'll excuse you. And it was her sincerely held personal conviction that she did not want to serve on a jury. You may not come to that same conviction, but you might. But in that case, the judge told her, but you will be here every day in the courthouse that trial that you have been assigned to. I don't care what you do. You can read a book, you can bring your knitting, but you're going to sit outside the courtroom, and if you're not here every day, you could be fined or you could go to jail. So judges have those kind of powers in our society. And if you're willing to put up with the penalty, then you can do that. But I don't tell people that they should not serve on a jury. That's not my, I got a jury summons the other day for August. That's not my duty as a minister to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. It may be that it is a very deeply held personal conviction. Maybe it is one, and I'm not going to cast aspersions on anybody, for a deeply held personal conviction that has been researched by you, that's fine. But going beyond the hot topics, there probably has been for centuries, but the most important matters remain. They're still here. Now, during five decades, I've experienced a great deal. The do's and the don'ts are usually not the backbreakers. They're not the things that lead people astray in the faith. But the people of God have been tested throughout that time in the modern era in a myriad of ways. Sometimes it's been doctrine. Many people came through with flying colors on that one. Sometimes it's been issues of governance, authority, have tested people. I remember there hadn't been any up until the very early 70s. There hadn't been anybody that really left the Church of God and formed another church until, I think it was right around 1974, with a cadre of ministers who led some of their congregations into a different organization. They had trouble with, we find out what the other problem was, I'm not going to mention that, but hundreds of people left the church in 1974. And then, you know, that first dam broke, so to speak, and it seemed as though it was easier as the decades followed for people to leave. How much authority the church has had over the lives of its members and how compliant to a particular set of instructions were sometimes tests for people. There were many of them. There were many different things. There were issues that were on the periphery, things that people felt, the church felt, could be proven from the Bible, makeup and divorce and remarriage, and all of these things are issues of the way gone past. Now, I'd like to give you a broad principle that I think you can live with, and it's not my principle. It was given by another minister to a lot of us in the church at that time. And that is this: whatever God has entrusted to you, that is, whatever your personal area of authority is, rule over that with zeal. Whatever it is that you have under your personal authority, and for most of us that involves ourselves, our families, and probably not a whole lot after that. We may have an obligation at times to our brothers, and we talked about that in the chat, and I'll go into that in a little bit later. But whatever you do, do that. Whatever you're assigned, do that. Now, I've expressed my frustration on issues from times, you know, to my wife, to Mr. Tannert, but there, you know, we talk, we have candid discussions, we discuss things, you know, and some of you get together and you discuss things in your coffee club and everything. That's good. I mean, you discuss issues that are important to you and you try to do that. That's great. But this has always stood me in good stead. You know, whatever God has entrusted to you, do that responsibility and do it to the best of your ability. Many years ago, well, today we have Ambassador Bible College, and it's a short course in Bible learning and Bible training and, you know, all the various books of the Bible. We have one graduate here with us, Sheila, who went to Ambassador Bible College. It's open to anybody, and it's just, you know, a great set of classes for somebody who wants to learn more about the Bible. You pay your own way, and you go there at your own risk, so to speak, but you make a lot of friends, right, and have some nice things. Back many years ago, we had three college campuses. We had one in Bricketwood, England, which was just north of London. We had one in Big Sandy, Texas, as Mr. Waterhouse used to say. We had one there, and we had one in Pasadena at the church headquarters. And they were all different. You know, Mr. Armstrong liked to say this. I don't know where he came up with this expression. He used to say that the campuses mutually excelled one another. Now, what does that mean? It means that they were all different. Now, they were all nice, and I've been to all three of them. The one that I was assigned to go to was Bricketwood, England. My parents were happy. They weren't in a church, but they were happy and excited that I was going back to the United Kingdom. I'd be close to Scotland, where they were both born. So they were kind of happy about that. They never became church members, but they appreciated the fact. My mother had a cousin who lived in London, and I got to visit with her on occasion on a Sunday. She came up to the campus, and I'd go down to London. One day she took me around to virtually every sightseeing stop in London. She knew that city like the back of her hand, and we'd get in the tube, as they call it, and go from this place to that place, the subway, for those of you from New York. But the campuses were different. They were all great, but the English campus was more formal. Many times, just to go to class, this is how we dressed every day. At least, if not a jacket, a tie. Most everybody wore a tie. I mean, then nobody said you got to wear a tie, but just when you arrived, first day, going to class, everybody's getting ready, all the upperclassmen are dressing up, so you kind of get the hint. You probably were warned beforehand that, you know, there's a more formal atmosphere. You're going to class, it was like, wow, it was more formal. You get used to it. The weather certainly didn't restrict the formal wear because it was always cold in the wintertime. The Big Sandy campus in East Texas was huge. It was sprawling. It was thousands of acres, and it was amazing too. The Pasadena campus was the headquarters of the work of God at that time, as many people know. But you know, basically, all three campuses taught the same thing. I'm going really far back into ancient history, but there were differences. There were differences. Big Sandy was a lot less formal than even Pasadena. And so among the students, sometimes these small differences would be accentuated. Well, hey, they're not doing it like we do. They don't even wear ties when they go to class. That was horrific. That was awful in the minds of some. And sometimes some controversies arose that became huge issues among young people, the combined student body. You know, these controversies raged. But when students got together from the three campuses, I was doing a little research earlier this week and ran across an old name of a archaeologist in Israel by the name of Benjamin Mazar. And he was a doctor at Hebrew University, and he is the one that organized the dig at the Temple Mount area. And our college participated in that Jerusalem dig for a number of years. Well, when the students from all three campuses would get together, they would be selected, you know, maybe 10 or 15 from each one to go down to work with the students at Hebrew University. You know what they found out? They found out that everything was really so similar that there wasn't really any important difference between the three campuses where they're teaching from the Bible. And that was a good thing. But still, when you're young and you really haven't had much experience in life, sometimes a mountain is made out of from a molehill. So the sage advice then from faculty members that we all respected and now as well is don't overreach. Don't overreach. If it's not within your sphere of responsibility, you're not accountable for it, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Don't get stressed. If you have authority in a certain area, then you can exercise it. But they wrote a book years ago entitled Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. Right? Don't sweat the small stuff. I got some funny stories for you. At least I'm debating as to whether or not I should use one of them, but we'll see when we get to that part in the message today as to whether or not I'll use that, but I think I probably will. In Matthew chapter 7 and in verse 3, this is just one of many injunctions that Christ used. We can certainly relate to it, at least I hope we can. In Matthew chapter 7 and verse 3, some of the areas that I have been talking about the last 2 weeks revolve around this issue of judgment. Now, the title of the sermon is Justice, Mercy, and Faith, but the real intent of the word here is condemnation, not just arriving at a judgment, but being condemning of an individual. So in Matthew 7, in verse 3, it says, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank that is in your own eye? We used to, as students, make fun of this, that you know, when somebody, and you get in close quarters as students, and you're correcting each other all the time, I mean virtually daily. And so we used to tell somebody that was especially critical, you know, hey, can you turn your head over that way? I don't want to get clobbered by that 2x4 that's coming out of your head. Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. More on that a little bit later. So that was an important lesson for us to learn as young adults, as college students, and it remains a valuable lesson to learn for everyone today. Obviously, there is a time and a place to intervene. So I'll just go to that right now and show you what is really important, and it really has a lot to do with justice, mercy, and faith. Turn to the book of Galatians. Galatians chapter 6. It's very interesting. You know, since I've touched on this area of condemning and judgment and all that sort of thing, remember, there is a time and a place for everything. But you have to really pay attention to the instruction here. This has to do with something that's really important, okay? And it's not as though, as a casual acquaintance, that you can actually do this, because you could probably misinterpret something. It's very, you know, jumping to conclusions, sidestepping responsibility, running down other people. That's the exercise that a lot of people get, right? You know, so you have to really be careful. It says, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual. Okay, do you want to assume that mantle? You're spiritual? Maybe you are. Maybe you're the right person for the job. You could be. But note, if somebody is overtaken in a trespass, that means overtaken in sin, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. Gentleness. Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. This is a very thoughtful process that requires time and prayer and preparation, right? Because this has to do with sin. Apparently, in this case, one that may be continuing. But it goes on to say, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. This is all about justice, mercy, and faith. For if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But here's what you do. Let each one examine his own work. Then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. For each one shall bear his own load. In the end, you're responsible. You're responsible for your own actions. Your brother has an obligation when you're sinning. We used to have, as young people, a sermon that topic that was repeated in Ambassador College. For some reason, I don't know, during those years, but it was going to your brother alone. And this going to your brother alone thing is a good thing, but it can be overdone. Now, you don't go to your brother alone because you think that he needs to shine his shoes more often. I mean, that's not what the law is all about. It's not because of some trivial matter going to your brother. It's something that has to do with sin. A number of sermons ago, I mentioned that the Pharisees and the Sadducees were a part of the church. Yeah, they were a part of the Old Testament church. Apparently, and I borrowed the information from John O'Gwin. I remember years ago when I was a ministerial trainee, he taught that to us when I was a trainee in Corpus Christi, Texas. But they were, and it really fits. And you can say you don't agree with it, but there was a church in the wilderness. That's very clear from the scriptures. There appear to be seven epochs of that church and that group of people, the church, just as there are seven New Testament eras in Revelation 2 and 3. And so let's just assume that John was correct and I'm correct in quoting him, and that they made up the last era of that church, which was replaced by a New Testament church at Pentecost, right? Because there was a new temple. There was a new priesthood at the time of Pentecost. And prior to his crucifixion, Jesus pointed out to his disciples that what really looked permanent really wasn't. Turn to Mark chapter 13. Mark chapter 13. Verses 1 through 4. Then as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. You can do a little research if you know how to use a search engine, and you can take a look, and you can, and they even have replicas of this temple, which was called the Second Temple. It was actually an addition to the Second Temple, because the Second Temple that was finished during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, Haggai and Zerubbabel and a lot, that temple was, even as it's noted in the Old Testament, a very kind of weak facsimile of the original temple that Solomon completed. But it was a temple. But Herod came along in the first century before Christ. They call it the first century BCE now. And he built this magnificent addition to the temple that was in existence at that time. And it's commonly referred to as the Herodian Temple, built by Herod the Great. Herod the Great was noted as an individual who was a master builder, and he engaged on this incredible building and construction plan. And when you see the replication, and even you see whatever is remaining today, the massive stones that were used, and they had to build up part of a mountain in which that temple was located. They had to build it up because one part, I think it was the southern part, the mountain was just, it was at an angle. So they built that up with foundational stones and just kept filling and filling and filling. And the indications from John 2 and verse 20, don't turn there, indicate that that temple was 46 years in the building process. So they quarried the stones. Some of them made hundreds of tons apiece, and they refined them further. They didn't need any cement. They all fit very, very nicely. So it took a long, long time with construction methods of the time. But this is what the disciples of Christ were referring to here and in Matthew 24 as well. This incredible temple. Now, Jesus would come to that temple. He came to that temple. It was the center of instruction and learning for all of the Jewish world at that particular time. The smaller stones at the temple were of the 12 to 15 ton variety. Now, how they moved them from the quarry, they say the quarry site was higher than the temple site, so they had at least gravity working in their favor, but how they pulled those stones and put them all together and did it, you know, with ropes and pulleys of the ancient day, it's incredible. So the temple was important to maintain as a religious center where knowledge was dispersed and law was kept and that sort of thing. But Jesus answered in verse 2, "Do you not see these great buildings? Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, and John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be?" Which begins the beginning of a great prophecy. But they were reflecting, and they were looking in the opposite mountain. They were looking over at the temple, and they were observing, and they were reflecting. And Christ gave this magnificent prophecy afterwards. What was really important to the Jews of that day were things like this great temple. It was incredible. But we know now that there's a different temple that is under construction. It's not physical. It's not made by hands, as the Bible said. But if you'll remember back in Matthew 23, don't turn there, but in Matthew 23, Christ called these religious leaders of the day hypocrites, blind guides, blind fools, whitewashed tombs, snakes, brood of vipers. That's pretty harsh invective on a group of people. Why? Because they missed the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. Now, you might say, wait a minute. How could they be held accountable for something that we commonly understand to be New Testament practice? That is, justice, mercy, faith, kindness, compassion. Now, how could we expect these letter of the law Pharisees and Sadducees to be held accountable like this? Christ called them every name in the book. But take a look. Take a look at the, quote, New Testament theology in the Old Testament. Turn to Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus 19 and verse 16, the things that we read in the New Testament oftentimes are just the repetition of what the law already prescribed for people to do. That's why the law wasn't nailed to the cross, wasn't done away with, or certain parts of it And we'll get into that more later on in the summer because I've had a request. I've had a request to speak about that, and I appreciate those things. I know that we all do in the ministry. We appreciate somebody says, okay, could you cover this topic? Leviticus 19 and verse 16 says, "You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people." You know, don't spread falsehoods about individuals. Don't even spread truths that are unflattering about individuals. "Nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord." This was a national law. This was a law that was imposed upon all ancient Israel in addition to the Ten Commandments. It says, "You shall not hate your brother in your heart." You know, that's something we find in the Beatitudes, right? Hate is equated with murder. "But you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him." And then it's in Galatians that Paul explains exactly the conditions upon which you might have to impose that kind of love to somebody. So it has to be a serious thing. "You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him," because you're liable. You know, Christ was asked that question, right? Who is my neighbor? Well, anybody that's in need, when you get down to it. Anybody that's in need. "You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudges against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Straight out of the Old Testament. That harsh, unforgiving law, the Old Testament. There's nothing new, right? You can see the similarity. If the scribes and the Pharisees had been actively teaching justice, mercy, and faith, which this law embodies, they wouldn't have any need for the Sermon on the Mount, because all of that is encapsulated in the Sermon on the Mount as well. It covers the same principles of what we would call Christian living. So they missed the purpose of the law altogether. And the terminology that I used last week, majoring in the minors, hot topics, issues that come up in the church today, this seem to be very important to people. And really, in some cases, they are, okay? No doubt about it. In some cases, they are important topics, but they're not worth splitting people up over. They're not worth that. They had missed, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they had missed the purpose of the law altogether. Turn to the book of James, chapter 1. James 1 and verse 25. "But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does." If a person looks into God's law and obeys it, he's going to be liberated from a lot of problems. Obedience to the law is required. If you're obedient to the best of your ability to the law of God, you're freed from future guilt, shame, the impact of sin, the impact of unrighteous doing, right? You're able to see yourself through the law, the mirror that is the law. You're able to see who and what you are. So the law is essential. It is necessary. But tithing mint, anise, and cumin and separating it all out, why don't you just give the whole plant, you know, to the temple? You know, why don't you just bring it all in instead of being so fastidious about this? It's a hyperbole. It's an expression that Christ used to show, you know, they got so bent out of shape over something silly when you get down to it that they forgot about justice, mercy, and faith. But the law is very important because it shows us who and what we are. And, of course, the law brings us eventually, if God is calling, to the time of baptism. Because then, as we read in Acts 2, people were being brought to Christ and to the sacrifice of Jesus Christ by the law because they recognized they had crucified somebody. They had committed murder. And they said, what do we do? We can't undo this. And you can't undo your life. You can't undo the things of the past. You can't undo something that you did 20 years ago. It's sin, whatever it was. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and you can't undo that. But mercy comes into play, and faith in the forgiveness of God. And there is still a temple. It's in the third heavens, and there is a throne room there. And Hebrews 4 says there's a great high priest who is not untouched by our infirmities. And so, yes, the law is perfect because it helps us to understand what future behavior ought to be like, and it also helps us to understand that there is forgiveness when there is wrongdoing. So if a person looks into the perfect law of liberty in the future and obeys it, the feelings of worthlessness, the feelings of loneliness, abandonment, all of that goes away. Keeping the law of God with its intended spirit and attitude brings real liberation. So the law or justice or judgment is a very good thing. You can compare yourself against it and you find you're going to come up short. And you're going to find that that is the reason for a savior, a personal savior, because you needed that. I needed that. The law reflects so you can see who you are. But to paraphrase what Christ was saying under the weightier matters of the law, judgment or justice means fair and even-handed. You know, nobody is above the law. Mercy is being compassionate and kind in action. God's people are like that. So it's more than just the translation of judgment. You know, trust, loyalty, all of this comes into being. Jesus Christ is speaking about justice and compassion and faithfulness. So in applying these concepts in confronting the Pharisees, they had reached a wrong conclusion concerning the law, or the intent of God's law. And you'll see that in just a second. Weightier means the more important or the central issues compared to tithing of herbs, which is kind of crazy when you think of it. If you'll turn to Micah chapter 6, I started printing to go green. I started printing my sermons on front and back, so I had to check here. Where am I on? Yeah, okay. I'm on page 5. Are we tracking? We're on page 5. Okay, good. But, you know, you get mixed up. You know, did I cover that side or go out of order? In Micah chapter 6 and verse 7, the prophet said, "Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams?" There was a sacrificial system. The temple was a place in which lambs, turtle doves, bullocks, all the animals prescribed for sacrifices for sin would be brought to the temple. But what is the intent of the law? Michael is showing, "Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, 10,000 rivers of oil?" That was a part of the sacrifices as well, right? Olive oil. "Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Justice, mercy, and faith, all from an Old Testament prophet. Years ago, I think to kind of inspire us as students and Ambassador College and to tell us of the high standard that as students we had to live up to, they called Ambassador College the West Point of God's work. Some referred to it as the Naval Academy of God's work. In England, they called it the Sandhurst. You know, Sandhurst is the, Dr. Meredith got over there and he, you know, was a real student of history and he, were the Sandhurst of the work of God. Strangely, nobody ever invoked the Air Force Academy. You're the Air Force Academy or the Merchant Marine Academy of God's work. For some reason, those things never Those never fit for, but anyway. So, story. In a women's dorms, this is on our campus in Brickettwood, England. More formal, okay? Every day, at least ties. I know that wasn't the way it was in Big Sandy, was it? I later went to Big Sandy, and Paul and I were graduating class together. So it was more casual. It's hot as blue blazes there. You're not going to wear ties all the time. Some of us did. I guess old habits die hard. But in a women's dorm, you know, probably 100, 125 women, a beautiful dormitory there on the Ambassador College campus, there were times in which they'd have measuring sticks. The girls all wore skirts or dresses. So sometimes, and they had a, what would you call her, Mrs. Horn, was an older lady that lived, she had her own little apartment in the women's dorms, and I guess she was there to be a mother hen or to keep order or something. Ellis, if he's watching, you'll remember Mrs. Horn. But sometimes they would have little measuring parties, I guess. Now, I wasn't a part of this, obviously, but Mrs. Horn would measure the skirts. Girls would get down on their knees, and I guess the prescribed length of a skirt had to be like an inch below the knee or right at the knee or whatever. And, you know, sometimes skirts were a little shorter than that prescribed. Whoever came up with that, somebody came up with that. That was back in the days when mini skirts were the rage, remember? So anything that got above the knee, you don't want to go there. So let's assume that it was an inch below the knee, but if it didn't make the cut, you're not allowed to wear it. So that's a standard. Nothing wrong with the standard, okay? I'm not derailing or decrying the standards of the day or anything else like that. They had a certain standard, that's what they wanted to it, but to make a big deal out of it, to embarrass somebody over it, would have been akin to being pharisaical, making somebody feel bad who didn't have it in their heart to violate the rules. And there were some of them like that. I mean, came over, you know, freshmen, every skirt is, you know, not an inch below, maybe mid-knee. Horror of horrors! Got to get a brand new wardrobe. But the administration of justice, mercy, and faith is to handle it in a quiet way without an embarrassment to the individual, because who wants to be made feel bad when they're not really trying to do something bad? You know, the Bible does say, cry aloud, spare not, and show my people their sins. I mean, I don't think you can call that a sin to be, you know, like within an inch of the prescribed standard. And standards of modesty are appropriate, okay? We understand that. Standards are standards. Modesty is a good thing, obviously. But Isaiah 58 isn't talking about these light and trivial things. He's not talking about skirt lengths or birthdays or, you know, that somebody came up with the idea, the pagans did this, so we can't do that. The pagans did this. Okay, that was a practice of the pagans. They had these things. They had this accoutrement. And so that means it's... Then somebody was really putting on their thinking cap, and they said, you know, the pagans also wore clothes. And the pagans also ate food. So, you know, not everything that the pagans did is against our standards of Christianity, obviously. But, you know, when that always gets me when somebody invokes the pagan thing. The pagan measurement. You can't do it because the pagans did it. In Isaiah 58 and verse 1, it says, cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet. Tell my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sins. And then in verse 6, it goes on to say, is this not the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bonds of wickedness and to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free and that you break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him and hide yourself from your own flesh. I guess this is a part of the law that was available to the Pharisees, but how often did they break out the scroll of Isaiah and read it? and find out that that's what the real obligation of the law was. No, they were out counting tithes of mint and anise and cumin. They were out doing these really huge, wonderful things for mankind that only they could possibly be obedient to. When you see the naked, that you cover him and hide yourself and not hide yourself from your own flesh. I mentioned last week how they went to elaborate lengths not to even take care of their own parents who might be in need. You know, this was part of the scroll of Isaiah that never made the light of day to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, or else they would have seen that they were missing the boat. Had they listened to this instead of the vast, strict codes that they prescribe for every aspect of human behavior, they wouldn't have been so concerned about the disciples, you know, how much water they poured up to their elbow to immerse their arms in washings before they ate bread. It wouldn't have been such a big deal. But that took on that takes on a life of its own. Brethren, it's happened in the eras of the church that we have lived in. The same thing. Now, again, not to the extent of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but, you know, sometimes almost. Turn to the book of John. Can you imagine how powerful they were in the day, though? They missed everything. They missed the whole point. Boy, this example is so ludicrous that it defies explanation when you think about it. John chapter 8. And verse 1, Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Now, early in the morning, he came again into the temple. Now, that beautiful Herodian temple, the massive stones and some of the walls 16 feet thick, amazing. Thought to be instructable, by the way, but the Romans tore it down in 70 A.D. or 69. Somewhere around there. Then, if you're going to be a real Pharisee, you're going to be a stickler for the date, the time, the month, everything, right? Then the scribes and the Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery, and they set her in the midst. Now, how this happened, you know, I don't even want my imagination to run free. How they caught somebody in the act of adultery. Adultery bad, yeah. Well, you know with the rest of the story. But can you imagine the manipulative way in which this must have been done just to try to prove Christ wrong on something? Verse 6, this they said, testing him that they might have something of which to accuse him. Now, we don't know what happened next, except Christ got down, wrote in the sand or the dirt or whatever. Maybe he listed all of their sins so that they had no excuse. Maybe he, of course, being God and man, he knew them better than they knew themselves. Maybe he just made a list. Everybody's sins, all the other things that were worthy of stoning according to the custom of the law. Verse 7, he who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. Have at it. But this is what you are. Hypocrites. You know, it's just unbelievable. They were so intent on tricking Jesus Christ, they hatched this incredible plot to catch this woman out. How twisted is that when you get down to it? How crazy is that? The administration of mercy escaped them. Obviously, it did not escape Christ. In Matthew chapter 9, I'm going to have to get used to this printing front and back thing. It's almost mixing me up. Boy, trying to go green, trying to be conserving, trying to save the planet. You know, look where it gets me, losing my places. Matthew chapter 9. That's what usually happens with environmentalism, you know. It's like the modern Pharisees. Just kidding to all of you environmentalists. Matthew chapter 9 and verse 13. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. In this, Jesus was using a phrase from, again, the prophet Hosea. Because the prophet Hosea, let's turn to Hosea. Boy, I can see I didn't put down the chapter, so I'm going to have to look that one up real quick. But turn to Hosea. Bear with me here. Okay, thank you. It might be it. Ah, yes. Chapter 6 and verse 6. Hosea said, and this is for all of Israel, for I desire mercy and not sacrifice, although the law required sacrifice, and a knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. But like men, they transgressed the covenant. There they dealt treacherously with me, and etc., etc. This is the expression. This is exactly what Christ meant with his final encounter with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This is justice, mercy, and faith. You know, so the law is good, right? Nobody mistakes that. But sometimes the measurements, the administration of rules, opinions, and customs that become condemnatory toward others, and our own ideas of the parameters of human behavior and what is appropriate and what is not appropriate, sometimes can be judgments against people who, in their own view, are very innocent of what you think may be wrong. Here's an example of what I mean. I'm 30 years old, probably the first, what we used to call, for those that are not familiar, ministerial refreshing programs. We went, you went, I went. We'd go in for a couple of weeks to Pasadena for a refresher. Okay? It was kind of good. I mean, it was good in a way. It was bad in a way. You didn't have your kids with you. So that part is real bad. It was really, really bad. Part that was good. Everybody's learning together, relearning together, covering some of, you know, you get people from all over the world in the church. You know, what's happening here, what's happening there. You share experiences. Overall, good. Well, we happened to be assigned or choose a January of 1 year. I can't remember the year. It was probably about 30, though. So it was 35 years ago. And being the good husband, on a Sunday morning, they put us in apartments there on campus. Everybody, we were in apartments. And they didn't have any washers and dryers in the apartments, or at least the ones we were staying at that particular time. So this is the one I debated. Okay, am I going to use this? I even debated even a little earlier ago. Am I going to use this example? I'm going to use the example, okay, to point out things that sometimes we think are really super important, but to the other person, it's really quite an innocent thing. So, again, being the good husband, as you know that I am, I told Terry I would do the laundry. And we had a few things that we needed to launder, so, but you had to pay for it. They're all coin-operated machines on campus. Well, I didn't pay for it. I don't know. But anyway, we're there, and I'm punching in a quarter. You know what it's like going to the laundromat, and I'm doing all this stuff. And we happened to be sharing the refresher program with virtually all of the Spanish-speaking ministry, most of them who didn't speak a word of English. Some did, but it was all the Spanish-speaking ministers, all from South America and Central America, Mexico, and they were there. There was a young couple. Now, I think they were from El Salvador, and they seemed very pleasant, nice people, but they brought their little baby, their infant, and they also brought along the mother-in-law who was taking care of the baby while they're all going to class. So I'm there punching in the quarters, washing, drying. They come in, and it was a small area, like, how big would it be? You know, like maybe that room area, maybe a little bit bigger than that. And so we're all kind of in close quarters and that sort of thing. And they bring the baby in with them. Couldn't have been more than a couple of months old. And I'm there just minding my own business, probably out of magazine while the clothes are drying. And all of a sudden, mom decides it's time to feed the baby. And she begins to feed the baby right there in front of me, big smile on her face. No blanket covering baby or mom at all. Get the point? I was horrified. Terry! So I went to Leon Walker, you know, a couple days later. I said, oh, you know, hey, got a question here for you. This is going to sound a little weird. Describe the situation to him. He said, it's very common in the Latin world. He says there's not the kind of shame associated with that, or that people think is shame or whatever. It wasn't considered immodest in their country for that to happen. Now here, whoa, that's kind of crazy. But you know what? It's not considered immodest in that culture. Well, at least that's what Leon Walker told me. So, I mean, but you wouldn't do it here. So what did I do? What did I do? Well, you know what I did. I had to go on a campaign to outlaw bear breastfeeding in the Latin world, right? Had to go to all those, had to be the missionary of breastfeeding, you know, and what's appropriate in that case. No. I did have Terry go down and do the laundry from then on, but so didn't do anything else other than that. But, you know, I mean, you could get all upset about something like that, or you could just accept that there's nothing intended by the whole practice. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy, you know, I can just hear you people in El Paso. Yeah, I just, you know, you're close to the border. You'll have some, you know, I'm sure you're going to have some rich stories along with my fat face to tell me when I get there. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. Now the purpose of the commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. That's justice, mercy, and faith, brethren. The purpose of the commandment is love. It's all in love. It's for the sake of love. It's defined. The law is defined very, very well. But you know what? You find out that there were hot topics in Timothy's day as well. Things that people were majoring in the minors even back then. Check out verse 3. As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, remain in Ephesus that you may charge that they teach no other doctrine. You know, some of the hot topics become de facto doctrine. That's the danger. Nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies which cause disputes rather than godly edification which is in faith. You know, when you get down to it, God could have made it so that there were no gray areas, no uncovered breastfeeding, I guess. He could have said all of those things, you do this, you do that, but then you would be restricted from using the Spirit of God and your own brains to develop justice, mercy, and faith in your life, and to be balanced and not be, okay, am I doing this right, doing that wrong? You know, sometimes life is about making mistakes and recovering from them, you know, learning from what you did that was wrong. I mean, it would be great if we all didn't sin, but we do. But we have to learn. We have to learn the administration of justice, mercy, and faith. And there were these hot topics there at the time of Paul. In verse 6, it says, from which some, having strayed, have turned aside to idle talk, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say nor the things that they affirm. You know, he goes on, he talks about the purpose of the law, but then he comes down in a very personal way, and he says in verse 15, this is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptance, that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief. However, for this reason, I obtained mercy, that in me first, Jesus Christ might show all long-suffering as a pattern to those who are going to believe on him for everlasting life. Paul is saying, in other words, if I can do this, somebody that was taking in people and hauling them off to prison, if God can change my life and help me understand what justice, mercy, and faith is, then he can do it in your life as well. As I said, in some cases in the past, some things became de facto law or rules. Talked about you know, people delivering each other's babies. That, you know, going back to the 50s, you know, that was a thing. That was a church thing. Hopefully, There weren't many problems because of that. Not every practice that we have in even today's world can be used to support a biblical injunction. So the point is, be cautious in the hot topics. Paul says, in effect, in chapter 1 of 1 Timothy, that it's easy to get lost in controversy. It's easy to become so involved that the issues of the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith are forgotten. Now, godliness is defined a few chapters later in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 16. Now, it's not as though this is all you need, or that this is the only thing, or that the rest of the law is unimportant, but here is a very succinct thing about, a very succinct passage about what godliness is, the mystery of godliness, which is obscured to many. God was manifested in the flesh, of course, in the person of Jesus, justified in the Spirit, seen by angels, preached among the Gentiles, believed on in the world, received up in glory. Again, not as though this is all you need. But do you want to grow in godliness? Do you want to grow in justice, mercy, and faith? Do you want to go above and beyond? Yeah, you do. You want to go above and beyond. Then don't be like the two little five-year-old boys arguing over a golf ball. I can just see them there scrambling in the grass. Oh, my, that is so funny. Become a master in the administration of justice, mercy, and faith wherever God allows you to rule.